A couple things. First, some of you have heard some of what I'm going to talk about at the memorial service for Bob, so I apologize for those of you that did hear this. And second, because we have a reception afterward, I hope many of you that have other stories to tell will share those with Bob's family. I think they would especially love to hear those. What a person. What a life. How do you sum up the life and the persona of a giant like Bob O'Neill? He was somebody who was inspiring, he was energizing, and he was also a little bit exasperating at times. But in one or many ways, Bob really changed the lives of many of us that are in this room. One description I like to think of for Bob, it came from the book Still Life with Woodpecker by Tom Robbins in describing the protagonist, who was a red-haired male. And the description was, or the phrase was, "God knows he'll stir the stew." And to me, that was what Bob was all about. But when I was thinking about describing his life and career, I was looking for metaphors, and I wanted to do so as a set of three. There's something magical about threes in our culture, whether it's Caesar's Veni, Vidi, Vici, the three furies of mythology, the three musketeers, Thoreau's three chairs, children's stories, sports, religion, and science. And so, and I'm sparing you the numerous entomological examples of threes, but plenty of these throughout life. The first one that came to mind, and sorry for this, is because Bob really was all three of the Stooges at various times. And I say that with absolute respect, because he truly was. But the triad that I'm going to use is the lion, the scarecrow, and the tin man, because what they had, or what they sought, was what they already had, and that was the characters of heart, brain, and courage. And I think those really epitomize Bob. So those are the characters that I'm going to use in sort of an allegorical tale or description of Bob. And I'm going to do so by keeping with that recurring set of threes. And the first, I'm going to have three quotes by Robert Kennedy. The first of these having to do with Bob's heart, because Bob really did bend history. He did it through a series of small events that totaled great change. And those small events, I think, showed his heart. From an early age, Bob was known by his friends through his youth. Sorry to embarrass anybody or him by these. But his display of heart and love, I think, really accelerated upon meeting and marrying Liz and beginning a family. First through the birth of Jenny, nurturing of her as the other, as well as the twins, Nate and John, and then Elspeth. And Bob loved his family. Anybody that spent any time with him knew that. He talked about his family, loved them dearly. But those of us that either are sons or have had sons will be able to understand and appreciate that I learned from Bob that the three terms, knothead, knucklehead, and chowderhead, were actually terms of endearment. I won't say that he used them often, but in fact he did. Bob loved being around children, whether it was his own, with his own, or with children anywhere. He loved, as you heard, coaching and attending the soccer games of his kids. But it wasn't only his children. Everyone was a child that Bob enjoyed. And I think, as Susie said, Bob really was a child at heart. And he was in awe of and in love with life. Bob was known by his friends and the friendships that he made, and he kept those friends. So here we've got Forrest Mitchell from the 70s and Forrest Mitchell from the 90s. And many of us in, Bob kept those friendships throughout his life, and many of us in the room are privileged to either have been a friend of, or count Bob as our friend, or for him to count us as one of his friends. Late in his career, as you heard, he made a very strong friendship with Dave Oatland and the work that Dave Ragsdale talked about. And Dave Oatland described very well the trepidation of traveling for an extended time with Bob without really knowing him all that well. And how do you spend 3 weeks with someone that you may not know well? And he said after they arrived in Japan, after a long trip in the plane, uncomfortable, both of them tall, that they cleared customs and emerged into a larger room filled with people. And Bob said, Jesus, there are a hell of a lot of Japanese here. And so at that point, Dave knew that it was going to be okay to travel with Bob. They'd get along just fine. Bob loved fishing anywhere, anytime, any continent. The first time he went to the Richardson Wildlife Refuge, where he retreated often, Bob caught a boatload of bluegill. And Joe Maddox was there with us. And Bob started cleaning these fish, and he was not doing a very good job of it. And so Joe said, don't you know how to clean fish and how to fillet them? And so Joe showed Bob how to fillet this bluegill, and Bob said, can you show me that again? And so Joe, if you don't know Joe, anyway, he did another one, and Bob said, now what about this? And so Joe did another one, and what if you did this? And Joe did another one, and so when he was done, Joe had filleted the dozen or 15 or so fish, and when he finished then, he said, I think I've got it now. And but also when we would go there, Bob would fish before sunrise, and he would, at various times during the day, come back into the reserve in order to work and then head back out as quickly as he could to fish, staying until after sundown. First couple trips, Bob was designated, I'm sorry, the first trip, he self-designated as the cook. However, he stayed out fishing until after dark, came back in, took a shower, and then started dinner. And I think, John, we probably ate dinner about midnight. And so after that, I was the cook, and Bob would be out fishing until dark, and I would stand on the porch and yell my lungs out that it was time for dinner. He'd finally come in after a long time, dinner often cold or burned, and he'd say, when are we going to have dinner? And I'm certain that his first time of staying out there until midnight was to get somebody else to be the cook. And so that was me. As you've heard, Bob loved Latin America, especially Honduras and especially Zamorano. He spent two sabbaticals at Zamorano. He loved the school and its students, and he had an influence in his program that in service training at Purdue that was emulated at other places and impacted many, many people, many of them in the room tonight. Bob towered over many of the staff and students at Zamorano, and in fact there was a cleaning lady there, and she was probably not as tall as this podium. And she referred to Bob and John Obricki and myself as Los Tres Altos, because to her we were as big as the mountains that were nearby. As you saw this earlier, a true love for Zamorano. This was on one of the courses that we taught there. Traveling around the country. You know, this a lot of his travel occurred shortly after the war, the Contra war against the Contras. And I think that actually Bob and John Zenger in the back may have been still on contract with the CIA when this picture was taken. Of the two of them with Ray Cloyd and with Luis Cañas, as you see. Louise showed this picture, and Bob's tales of driving in Honduras were legendary. My favorite was him passing a bus that was passing a semi, going around a curve up a hill in the rain. And it sounds like a country western song, "All We Need Is a Dog and Somebody's Mother," but in every combination. And you had to believe that he wanted to live as much as I did in order to get through that. One time he took a group to Lake Yohoa, and if you knew Bob, and you know he was a gregarious person, loved to bring people along, and so we were going to leave at 8 or 9 in the morning, and I was all ready to go, and around 10 o'clock we were still thinking about this a little bit and putting things together, and then he invited somebody and somebody else, and they couldn't quite go yet, and somebody else, and we finally left about 2:30, which was fine, but he had one of these small pickup trucks, and he had seven people, and it could seat about four if you really pushed it. So the others rode in the back, which was fine. But late afternoon in tropical countries often result in pretty serious rainstorms. And so before we got to the lake, we hit one of those. And so we had to stop, and everybody had to pile inside these little bitty trucks, seven people in a tiny pickup. I was mad as hell at Bob for doing that, because if we had left when we were going to, we wouldn't have had had the rain. But Bob, through all of that, he absolutely loved life. He had a heart as big as Texas or Honduras. Loved his family, his friends, his students, fishing, and Latin America. The second of these quotes by Kennedy, Bob was a dreamer, and he asked an awful lot of times, why not? He was truly bright and a real idea person. From his very early days as Bob the Bug Man, if you can't quite read it on the, imagine you're a grade school or preschool child, and something like this comes into the room, and we wonder why children are entomophobic. But from those early days, he then went to Florida as a grad student, developed his career studying predation, and that's much of what, as you heard from Susie, what we know about him. Bob grew up in Boston. He went to Amherst for his bachelor's degree, and growing up in Boston, Bob considered Amherst the West. And he left Amherst and went to College Station, Texas. So if he thought Amherst was the West, you can imagine, had his Volkswagen not broken down when he got to College Station, he would have turned around and gone back. I won't tell some of the College Station stories, just two of them quickly. One, as Susie said, Bob was a friend of bureaucracy, and so every semester, he told me, every semester at A&M you had to fill out a card that said not only your name and address, but what sex and race you were, as though it had changed from the previous semester. And so Bob said he would just check different boxes at various times. And so when he was at Purdue, he got a letter, and he had been named a distinguished black alumnus. I'm sorry, the term actually was, because Texas A&M, it wasn't alumnus, but former student. And so he was a distinguished former black student. And he said, you know, that was him. Bob also discovered with the secretary in the department a little bit of hijinks. Put his face in the Xerox machine, and this is about the time the Shroud of Turin stuff going on. And in going through, leafing through papers, the secretary was apparently quite devout, and leafing through these papers, and at the time, looking with his beard like this, he found this image in the papers, and proclaimed to the secretary, Ms. Lewis, that Jesus was in the Xerox machine. Although I guess after a little while, and she kind of looked at the image and looked at him, and Liz, I think it took a long time before she would speak to him again. But after A&M, where he worked with Jim Cate for a master's degree, he went to University of Florida, where he worked with Jerry Stymack for his PhD. He got his PhD at the age of 27, which the alert listener knows is the cube of three. He was then ready to move out and move up, and he took off for Purdue, arriving in the fall of 1984. At Purdue, Bob's, and I think, yeah, Bob's the second one from the left there. His career, his science, and his stature evolved rapidly. And that's where I first met him in 1984. I don't know if you know, but I was his first grad student. When I found my way to his office, he was still unpacking boxes. And I said that I was wanting to work with him as a grad student. And he said he wasn't interested, so go away and find somebody else. The lesson to those of you younger faculty, that's not how you start a graduate program. But I persisted. I went back about 3 weeks later, and his boxes were mostly unpacked, and we sat down, we talked a long time, and we absolutely clicked. We made a wonderful team. It was just a joy to work with him. And about the time I finished my degree, he asked, why did I choose to work with him? He was a modeler, he was a quantitative ecologist, he was a hotshot new faculty when I chose to work with him. What was it? And I said, well, that first day that I came and talked to you and we were sitting in your office, I noticed that you had on, Susie, one blue sock and one green sock. And I figured if you didn't take yourself too seriously, we were going to get along just fine. Bob did a lot of his work in southern Indiana in Bedford. He fixed up this old scooter that he found that he would drive out to the field. Susie and I would walk to the field. We lived in this old trailer. Were any of us ever this young at that point? We lived in this old trailer which was infested by mice and was a wonderful place to work. Bob enjoyed Bedford, Indiana and all of its curiosities. Greatly. Bob was an idea person, as I said, but also a quantitative ecologist. He was often brilliant. Equally often, his ideas were harebrained. He was always creative, and he was nearly always had the right idea at the right time. And he was a big idea, picture person, big ideas, not a detail kind of guy. You may want to know that when he was elected chair of the section CA, Biological Control Section in ESA, he wasn't a member of ESA, he'd forgotten to pay his dues. When he was vice president of IOBC, he was not a member of IOBC, he'd forgotten to pay his dues. But when he did finally pay his dues and was in charge of the mixer, Tim Kring was president that year, Bob got a look at the menu and he thought, hey, I like sushi and I like chicken wings. And so that year the bill for the mixer for IOBC was roughly $2,500, something like that. Look at the chips in the back and you see why we only can afford chips now. He was often a little bit off on some of his numbers. We were going to drive to Des Moines, Iowa one time, and he said it would take about 4 hours from West Lafayette. It's 454 miles, and even Susie Legaspi could not make that in 4 hours. And Susie was known for her driving skills. Bob had developed a weight loss plan when I was a grad student. He and I used to go to the Union after we'd eat our lunch in the lab. We'd walk to the Union to get ice cream. And then in the Village opened a shop that sold frozen yogurt. And it had half the calories, and it was twice as far to walk. And so it was a surefire way for us to lose weight as long as we went every day. you can imagine the outcome, and I show the outcome. Susie showed his search equation and some of the math that went behind that. We met one time with Jeff Lucas, another quantitative ecologist, and Bob was doing the integration of the expression of that curve with a functional response and seeking where the energetic trade-off was and doing a double integration and doing something or some subsequent step with that. And Jeff pointed out, well, in fact, he stopped him. He said, stop, you can't do that. And Bob said, what do you mean? And he said, I think you've violated nearly every rule of calculus. And this is the calculus of Newton, Leibniz, and Riemann, that famous triad. Bob developed, I was originally going to work on Navis, and Bob developed a wonderful plan, experimental design, random sampling, rearing methods, how to deploy these out in the field, everything about them. Except the day before we went to the field and we thought we'd just see how many Mexican bean beetles Navis would eat, and in fact they would not eat Mexican bean beetles. There was a minor detail that was overlooked. They would starve before they would eat Mexican bean beetle, which actually we developed a paper on. We published that, truly. And Bob was brilliant, and that was epitomized. He showed me one time, he got a letter addressed to Dr. Robert Entomology, and he said that just summed it all up. He was entomology. He was brilliant, but he couldn't tell what direction was east. We stood out in a soybean field at dawn, and I asked him to tell me which way was east, and he couldn't do it, and I'm sure that's a function of growing up in Boston. I said, which way is east? And he said, or which way does the sun come up? And he said, over the ocean. So one story I will tell, another detail, and many of you were at the Vidalia conference in 89, and Bob and I were going, and we bought our tickets early. Some of you have heard the story. And then Bob realized that his brother lived in Los Angeles, and so maybe he could buy a different ticket and trade it with somebody and then have them buy the ticket that he, for the itinerary he really wanted. And so the person who was going to the meeting, who had not yet bought the ticket, was a Panamanian woman named Gladys Gonzalez. And so this is pre-9/11, you can do this. So I traveled with Gladys, who was under the name of Bob O'Neill, and whenever I would check us both in, I'd say, here are our tickets, and they'd say, where is O'Neill? And I said, you know, he's not feeling well. He's in the bathroom. Oh, okay. So we flew all the way out there and back, no problems. Bob flew out there with no problems, but the day of return was the day that the time changed, and so he took the rental car back to the airport and found that he had missed his flight. And like many other knucklehead males that were there that had also missed that, he was on standby. And so, here it comes. So they're calling names, and they call Gonzalez. And he said, these guys are kind of looking around at each other. And said, Gonzalez, Gladys Gonzalez. And Bob said, oh, that's me. So remember, this is somebody who's 6'3", red hair Irishman, going by Gladys Gonzalez. Bob always took copious notes. Anybody that worked with him, traveled with him, knew that. But all of that brilliant thinking really wore him out sometimes. And so he had to go back to do some deep thinking while Susie and I were still out in the field. So indeed, Bob had a brain. His ideas influenced and impacted many of us. We get the luxury of standing on the shoulders of a giant like Bob. Finally, courage. How do you define or measure courage? Standing up for ideals, empowering the lot of others, or improving the lot of others. Those were Bob. Someone needed to be the one to point out when the emperor did not have clothes, and that was Bob. He swam against the current, to use a fishing analogy. He saw what needed changed, and he set about to change it, as John said, as Susie said, as Louise said. He wasn't satisfied with the status quo. Bob, in fact, was an iconoclast, and I use this term in the most deferential way possible. It's not the pernicious institutions that he fought, although some of them certainly were, but really those that were erroneous. He took on bureaucracy and he loved using bureaucracy against itself. One story he told me came from his Florida days when, you remember in the early 80s, there were sinkholes around Gainesville, and apparently Bob and Susan Braxton got one of the state vehicles and went out to see these. And of course, they wouldn't let anybody in. He pulled up and they said, sorry, you can't go any further. And he said, I'm from the Department of Sinkholes. And he said, the person said, oh, okay, well, you just go back there. And who on earth, other than Bob, would have the audacity to do something like that? His early days at Purdue, he wanted to buy a van, and they wouldn't let him have an air conditioner or a radio. And he said he needed the air conditioner because they had to transport insects and keep them in good shape. So that worked. He couldn't have a radio, but he said we needed a radio because of weather and safety out in the field and knowing when we could put our experiments out. So then they let him have a radio, but not for any other reasons. As you heard from John, the committees that Bob began because he wanted to get things done, and he did. And the first of these, the Lady Bird Committee, came about meeting in a room in the Amway Hotel in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Doug Landis was there, Joe Maddox, Stan Marr, John Obricki, Bob, and myself. And as John said, everything had to have a name. And so Bob thought we should come up with a name, and since we were in the Amway Hotel, it was going to be the Amway Committee. And any of you that knew Joe Maddox, Joe threw a pencil down on the pad and said, damn it, I'm not serving on any damn Amway committee. And so as we were leaving the room, we noticed there was a plaque on the wall that said this was the room that Lady Bird Johnson had once stayed in. And so it became the Lady Bird Committee, not for entomological reasons, but because of Lady Bird Johnson. The L2E committee came about. There was a meeting in February in Chicago, and there was a tremendous blizzard. But we were staying at a Best Western hotel on Toohey Avenue in the north side of Chicago. And this was a meeting to talk about doing international work. And so Bob suggested that it be the Best Western committee. And Joe Maddox, again, pencil, probably same pad of paper, threw it down and said, damn it, I'm not serving on any Best Western committee. And so Bob decided we should name this after the street. And because it was to do international work, particularly in Latin America, you had to put the word L in front of it, and that made it Spanish. And I wished, heavens, I could remember what the TUI stood for. Somewhere he's developed some stationery for that. And in fact, when he wanted to have a course and wanted to invite Eliana Fontes from Brazil to this course, she was not able to get permission to go to the course. And so Bob had Matt, I can't remember Matt's last name, in the lab develop some letterhead, because letterhead makes everything official. And so it had L2E at the top, and then it had at the bottom in the footer, it had a quote or a misquote from Dan Quayle. And so he, yeah, no kidding. And he sent the letter, the invitation to her. She took this to her administrator, and he said, oh, L2E, okay. And so she got to go to this meeting, all because of made-up stationery. The third of these, the squat committee, was an extension committee and kind of a play on a squirt and count and also a SWAT team. So they were the squat team when they went out. As you heard, Bob developed the Midwest Institute. Absolutely brilliant idea. If students can't, if the instructor cannot be everywhere, you bring the students to a series of instructors. Over the years, 18 years of Midwest Institutes, and there was an article published in February, or in the spring issue of American Entomologist, some 350 students that took these courses. It was called the Midwest Institute of Biological Control, but and here's Bob with one of his heroes. As Bob was probably the only person in the world who despised Ronald Reagan more than I did, and so having his picture taken next to this statue was, and Dal is in there as well as John. But the Midwest Institute also had an expansionist view of Midwest, and so it extended south to Honduras and east to southern France. And so if we had a map describing the Midwest, it would look like that. All sorts of tales of things at those courses, which I won't go into in the interest of time. The very end of his career, working on soybean aphid, as you heard, foreign exploration, studying a pest in its native habitat, traveling around here with Kim Holmer and on the Great Wall. If Bob could have put a Red Sox hat on the portrait of Chairman Mao, he would have done it. And I wish I had enough Photoshop skills. I should have asked Paul Odie to do this for me. Bob took on cherished ideas and, against all odds, as you heard from Dave Ragsdale, is making it work. So indeed, Bob had courage. And I think all of us can learn from his courage, the many ways that he approached life and truly stirred the stew. So I return to my metaphor of heart, brain, and courage, and I think I've convinced you Bob really had copious amounts of all three of these. He led a life filled with heart, filled with ideas, and filled with courage. He was my advisor, my mentor, and my friend, and I'm going to miss him. Thank you.